What You Missed This Week. I'm Scarlett Fu. This podcast has the best and most interesting interviews from the Daily Market Close show that I co-anchor with Joe Weisenthal, Caroline Hyde, and Romain Bostic on Bloomberg Television, What You Miss. Our aim is to take you beyond the headlines and bring you unique perspective on the week's top stories and those you may just have missed. This week felt like a year. Each day, the coronavirus outbreak further upended everyday life in the U.S. and Europe as major cities put massive social distancing policies in place, closing schools, bars, restaurants, gyms, movie theaters, and any other non-essential business. Life in the economic engine of the U.S., California, and New York grinded to a halt. The Federal Reserve didn't even wait for its own midweek meeting. The central bank took surprise action on Sunday evening, cutting its benchmark interest rate to near zero and announcing it would buy $700 billion in bonds. That news also upended our planned Fed special, but we kept the guests around to talk about the economic fallout from the virus and the response from governments and central bankers. First, we spoke with Scott Minard, Global Chief Investment Officer at Guggenheim, and Jeffrey Rosenberg, BlackRock's Systemic Fixed Income Senior Portfolio Manager.
Yes, Scarlett, I think this is playing out pretty much according to script. I think we still have downside room in the stock market. Corporate bond spreads have widened a lot. We only have been this cheap relative to U.S. Treasuries about 10 to 15% of the time historically, which means we're getting into the value zone. But as I remind people, value is a poor timing tool. And we're yet to see capitulation in areas like securitization. There's a lot of aircraft securitizations out there that are going to be extremely hard hit by airlines shutting down travel. And you know, until we see some forced liquidation, which for the first time today, I have a sense we are seeing that we're not going to come to a bottom.
What would capitulation look like to in your view? What would you be seeing as the signs? Because there are every day we're seeing moves in different asset classes that are sort of extraordinary. Today, it's a lot of currency volatility that had been sort of quiet for a while. We're also seeing incredible moves at the long end, people not wanting to hold long duration assets. What does capitulation and more of this sort of forced liquidation look like to you?
Well, you know, Joe, in the mini recession of 2015 and 16, as an example, we saw triple B CLOs trading at 60 cents on the dollar. Yesterday, and I haven't seen any trades today, they were trading around 85 cents on the dollar. Now, I would argue that what we're in today is a lot worse than the decline in energy prices we experienced in 2015 and 16, which caused a credit crunch. So, you know, the fact that these markets haven't moved there, I mean, I'd like to see this sort of paper trading around 50 cents on the dollar. Aircraft securitizations have been trading around 7%. I think they more appropriately are at 15%. Then, you know, the wholesale panic in the stock market, you know, even if we hit the next objective I have, which is around 21 to 2200, we're only going to be down 37%. And that is not what you would expect in a market like this. You would expect something more like 45 to 50.
All right, Scott, I want to bring in Jeffrey Rosenberg into this conversation. When we talk about the moves that we're seeing in this market, and really to Scott's points about the idea that we might be seeing a little bit of a liquidation here, this idea of everyone selling out those long positions, everyone selling out those short positions, and we combine that with the high volatility, you get this sort of weird feedback loop, Jeff. When is there anything that could sort of break that loop, and at a minimum we get some degree of stability?
Yeah, I think it's important to just kind of take a step back and appreciate just how fundamentally different this environment is and what is causing all the various unwinds and dislocations in financial markets has a very different root source and root cause. We are, of course, talking about the coronavirus's impact on the real economy. And unlike past crises that started in financial markets and then bled back into the real economy, this is going in the regular order. It's the real economy that is at a sudden stop. And what that sudden stop means is that companies have lost access to cash flow. That has pushed back into financial markets through an extremely large economy-wide sized demand for liquidity. The financial system was never designed and was never contemplated to have to bear that kind of sudden stop to the economy and push back into the financial market a demand for liquidity of that magnitude from the real economy. And so what you're seeing in financial markets is the implications of that, which is squeezing liquidity and balance sheet in every other aspect of financial markets. So it's in cross-currency basis, it's in treasury on the run, off the run, it's in the mortgage market, it's in the CP market, it's in the corporate bond market, it's in the deleveraging in risk parity and in hedge funds, it's everywhere. And so to understand the source, you can then understand the solace, the thing that's going to arrest that.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that is a major fiscal policy response. You know, you had Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen in the FT today arguing for a funding for lending scheme. Different kinds of emergency schemes than what we saw during the 08 crisis. You're seeing a lot of the 08 playbook getting kind of replayed, but it's a different environment and it's a different source. So it's really about getting the funding directly from fiscal sources, Treasury and taxpayer supported with federal funding that gets the liquidity of the size that companies need. When you get that, and you can see those are the programs that are being debated right now, when you get that, that will ease the burden on this demand from the financial markets that it can't bear, and we'll see the bottoming beginning to form when we get to that clarity.
Okay, you make a great case here for the demand for liquidity from the real economy reverberating in the financial markets here. But clearly, we're all accustomed to looking at things through this framework, through the lens of the great financial crisis. As policymakers bandy about big numbers, it was $1.2 trillion, now it's $1.3 trillion. Do we have the wherewithal to come up with a package that meets the needs of the real economy? Is an announcement of an agreement sufficient, or does the money have to hit the companies for stability to come back?
Well, the announcement helps because the announcement says the cavalry is coming, that you're not on your own, that you're not having to do it by yourself and having to rely on machinations and backup liquidity plans that were never contemplating this degree of stress in your fundamental operations. No one ever stress tested this degree of shutdown in liquidity. And so the preemptive kind of reaction is overstressing the financial market. So the announcement itself can let corporate financial officers, treasurers, businesses take a collective sigh out and say, okay, I have other sources. Now, eventually, yes, Scarlett, you've got to get those sources up and running. But just the idea that they're coming and you're not on your own can help to alleviate some of what we're seeing here as a lot of demand, you know, dashed for cash. Usually we think of that as a financial market concept, but it's really dashed for cash in the real economy that's happening.
Yeah.
And that can help to address some of that, you know, real panic that's going on.
Scott, one of the big question marks that hangs out there is what happens to the industries that are truly the tip of the spear of this economic crisis? And of course, talking about things like hospitality and hotels, but also airlines, and lots of talk about whether they will need a bailout and how much cash they have left. More headlines every day about them doing everything they can to conserve every dollar. What do you see as the fate of publicly traded airlines?
Well, I mean, look, the publicly traded airlines, there's going to be a big political debate here. And that is that over the last 10 years, in the wake of the great financial crisis, airlines have purchased back $45 billion worth of stock. Today, they're asking for approximately $50 billion worth of aid to bail them out. I think that is a political nightmare. The people who thought that the bailout of the big companies was bad in the financial crisis are going to look at this and say, why don't we let these people just go bankrupt? The reality is, in bankruptcy, Chapter 11 reorganization, airlines continue to operate. It's not like people aren't going to be able to fly their destinations. But, you know, I am an avowed capitalist, And, you know, there are situations where you have to allow the people that are getting the return for the risk actually bear the risk and not have the government bailing them out.
So, Scott, though, I mean, just to follow up on that point here, I mean, part of the concern here is that with certain industries, they're so interconnected with the rest of the economy. And so if you allow that risk to bear itself out in the extreme that this could potentially occur, does that not then hurt industries maybe that are adjacent to the airlines that maybe, I guess, for lack of a better word, deserve it?
Well, you know, Romain, that's a great question, and it's the question of moral hazard, you know, which has been building ever since the 1930s within the financial system. You know, I spoke with Treasury yesterday and the Office of Management and Budget, and my recommendation to them was if we really felt that an industry or a company like Boeing is so essential to the U.S. economy, then, you know, loan guarantees, you know, could be offered, but the borrowers should pay a fee to get them. They should pay the same thing you would pay if you were getting a letter of credit from a commercial bank. And in addition to that, they should get the government should get warrants on the stock, you know, 20% of the company. I mean, let's face it, we're asking the U.S. government to stand in the position of being a distressed investor. They need to think of it that way, and they need to build transactions which, you know, actually give upside participation to the taxpayers who are bearing the burden of this crisis.
Now, how we address the problems in the airline industry, of course, raises a question of how we address the problems in the hotel industry and the cruise line industry. Jeff, how do you see this playing out when it comes to the troubled industry and the targeted aid that we need to provide them? Does it necessarily set a precedent for how we do each address each industry?
It's very difficult for the reasons that Scott just laid out. It's a political nightmare. There are other ways of handling it. The fund for lending scheme, putting the onus more on the businesses themselves. I think this has been the Wall Street Journal op-ed perspective on this, to put the onus more on businesses themselves rather than politicians to dictate what the industries are that need it. But certainly the point of all of this conversation is that we need an airline industry. We need a hotel industry. And you want to avoid the unnecessary harm to the industries, to the employees, to the partners, to the clients, from a distressed situation
right.
of dealing with it in the pure default fashion. There are a lot of unnecessary costs that will be borne that you could avoid, and that's where government intervention can be helpful. The exact form is difficult. That's why this is in the phase three portion.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing some of that support, I think, is critical because that will help to alleviate the more longer dated harm. What we're going for here is we're in recession. The economy is shut down. It's how long will it last,
right.
and what will the economy look like on the way out? You want to maximize your ability to return to your prior and even above that. And when you don't implement these kinds of measures, then you're actually doing more harm than good. It's challenging to get the balance of interest correct, but the overall goal there should be to mitigate unnecessary damage.
Jeffrey, I just want to ask you what you make of the sell-off at the long end of government bond curves all around the world. 1.17 on the U.S. 10-year. It's not particularly high, but it is moving higher on a day that's extreme risk off. We saw it all across Europe today. What's driving it, in your view? Is it this handoff from monetary to fiscal? Is it extreme positioning? Is it the deleveraging of risk parity-esque-ish funds? What is the main catalyst, in your view, for this move and the way the odd behavior of it?
So there's a couple of things going on. These markets are moving so quickly that we're really talking about a number of different effects happening at different times. So the first one, the kind of odd behavior in some market days when we've been down big on stocks, and you have seen the back end of the market yields on the 30-year going higher, that's very indicative of what you were just suggesting, this kind of environment of risk parity off kind of move. But today, just to expand on that a little bit. And so the issue with the risk parity off means that strategies that relied on an expected relationship between treasuries and equities, those are breaking down.
Right.
They also rely a lot on leverage. And so the combination of the increasing cost of use of leverage, the uncertainty in what the hedge ratio and the relationship should be, is forcing those strategies to just de-risk both sides of the trade, reducing the equities and reducing the bonds. And so that's where you see that kind of odd behavior. I think what you saw separately today in coming out of Europe in terms of higher interest rates is really a new phase and a new question about what is the size of the fiscal policy response going to be, how will it be financed, and what is the ability of the ECB, I would say the ability and the willingness of the ECB to absorb that within the confines, construct, and constraints of its institutional makeup. I think you had a lot of questions going on around the ECB after Lagarde's comments that were, negatively interpreted by the financial markets. They've since walked that back. But there's a lot of uncertainty about how you manage that. I think ultimately it can be managed. It requires more aggressive intervention, perhaps the triggering of ESM and OMT, perhaps as Merkel was there were some headlines today about fiscalization at the euro level and Eurobond issuance. Yeah. That can all mitigate that. But in the uncertainty, there's a big price to pay for what we were talking about earlier, which is, very large fiscal support has to be funded. And so you saw some rise in yields as a result of that.
Okay, so Scott, come back into this conversation and talk about that fiscal support, because obviously that means a lot of government borrowing here. The general consensus seems to be that this is what's going to have to happen. You have more government borrowing at extreme levels. You have the Fed sort of peg interest rates down to zero or something very low. I guess the question is, what sort of distortions does that create for market participants in the fixed income market? And does this end up being something like a bridge that then gets unwound once we sort of get through this? Or is this going to end up being a long-term structural change to the fixed income market?
Well, Romain, to get to the last question first, this is going to be a long-term structural change. When you look at the volume of U.S. Treasury securities that are being issued, approximately $1.2 trillion a year, and then you look at domestic savings last year at about $1.2 trillion, corporate savings at $500 million, and then state and local deficits of $300 to $400 million. The savings equation was in balance, but now when we go into let's say a $1 trillion program, you have $2.2 trillion in borrowing. The corporate savings is disappearing. The personal savings isn't going to get any better because people are going to dissave to keep their houses and so forth. And I think state and local government's going to have to continue to spend or increase spending. So since that doesn't balance, that is, we have about $1 trillion or so, maybe a little more shortfall in the available credit in the financial system, it's going to force the central bank to have to participate and provide purchases of these securities. So our view is that ultimately this is going to be QE5, and that we would expect about $4.5 trillion of quantitative easing. But in the near term, to go to the private sector, this is crowding everybody out, and so the availability of credit to run business is essentially drying up right now, and it's becoming a crisis.
Are we going to need, Scott, a stretching, say, of the Fed's mandate to get the credit taps flowing again beyond this? I mean, you say QE, but, the government doesn't need more money to buy treasuries per se, or doesn't need a backstop for treasuries. As you say, it's private credit. Are we going to need, do you see, I mean, we had Bernanke and Yellen talking about backstopping or buying corporate debt, kind of like what Mario Draghi or what the ECB does. Do you see that here?
Well, I think they're going to have to revisit programs similar to TARP and TALF. You know, the TARP program was about $700 billion, as I recall. And then TALF was the troubled asset lending facility that was provided by the Fed if you got protection from TARP on first loss. I think, Joe, you know, we should probably expect something like that. I think it's absolutely necessary. And, you know, I've been saying that I think it would take about a $2 trillion TARP program and then a TALF program that would be as large as necessary. But one thing I'd like to just comment that Jeffrey said, and I agree with his comment, that we should try to avoid the unnecessary costs of bankruptcy.
Right.
But to try to salvage these industries or companies one by one is going to turn into a massive challenge because every one of them is going to have to go through Congress. And, you know, we see how slowly Congress has been moving on the existing legislation. So I believe it would be, you know, necessary here to just say, look, we're going to set aside a slush fund and it's going to have certain rules around it. And the administration, Treasury, the Federal Reserve can act quickly because I recall Lehman and the Thursday before Lehman failed, I think I was on Bloomberg. Talking about the fact that we would have to resolve Lehman by Sunday because on Monday we had to get to AIG and by Tuesday we would have to be with CIT and we don't have time to come up with solutions for every company. So, you know, I think it's ultimately going to require, you know, a massive program that doesn't have to go through approval for every transaction with Congress.
Another industry that, of course, is hard hit is oil, but we kind of almost put it aside. On any other day, it would be the lead story. It kind of has become the sidebar here in coronavirus era. Jeff, I want to get your take, because how do you fold in the plunging price of oil into your analysis? WTI, for instance, right now off 25%, hitting a low of $20.06 a barrel. The free fall that we have seen in oil prices is certainly a deflationary force, if nothing else.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Scarlett. On any other normal world, this would have been the main story, the Saudi-Russia catalyst. It's really just gotten buried as part of a much, much bigger story, which is effectively the major parts of the global economy on a temporary shutdown, which from the oil perspective is shutting down the demand. And so you have this major demand-side shock, and you have companies whose balance sheets can't stomach that, and that puts them into distress. But it's really become almost secondary because of the other issues. That's not to say that those aren't significant issues, and certainly where there's concentrations of exposures, you talked about earlier, you know, the impact in the high yield market. But we're really beyond these kind of, you know, in 2015, 2016, it was the only story. Here, it's part of a much bigger story, where the bigger story is, what is the recessionary impact? What is the distress impact Scott was just talking about across all of these industries? What will the policy response be to truncate and mitigate that? Or will it not be large enough and that the lingering effects lead to a deeper, longer recession? These are the much bigger, broader issues that once we get through this kind of technical issue of liquidity squeeze, which is what's affecting financial markets right now.
Yeah.
And we contemplate what does the shape of the recovery look like? Because, you know, we're in the middle of it right now, and everything seems very bad, and we're getting a lot of difficult headlines in our personal lives and with regards to the health and safety issues. But we will get through it. We know that is the case because we see that in the East. And as we do that, then we can contemplate what does the path of recovery look like. And that will very much hinge on these two issues. One, what is the efficacy and the strength of that fiscal policy response? And two, how much damage did we allow our economy to go through as a result of this dislocation? If we can mitigate the latter and improve the policy response on the former, you can get to a shape of recovery that's better, that kind of mitigates the long-term damage.
Scott, when you look at some of the dislocations we have had in the market and really the monetary policy response or the Fed response in general, there's been some discussion that the Fed should maybe broaden out the scope of what it buys, people talking about municipal bonds. We know that the market's been calling for some sort of term auction facility. We obviously don't have any indication whether that's going to happen, but we have seen some of the Fed presidents discussing this publicly. Do you think that there is more in this environment that the Fed can do on its own from a monetary policy perspective?
Well, the Fed really has its hands tied, especially in the wake of Dodd-Frank and the financial crisis, where more restrictions were put on them. They are not; they cannot buy municipal bonds or corporate bonds or equities directly onto their balance sheet. They can only buy U.S. Treasuries, agencies, and gold. They really are handcuffed until Congress gives them more authority, and it's going to take, I think, some leadership from the White House if they want to give that authority to the Fed. I would categorize what the Fed has done as necessary to this point, but not adequate. And let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. The $1 trillion commercial paper funding facility. It buys A1, P1 commercial paper. There's about $450 billion worth of A1, P1 commercial paper and about $500 billion of A2, P2 paper, which they can't buy. The A2, P2 paper are the companies that are weaker and actually are going to need the help to keep them going. So, the facility is great. I'm glad it's there to backstop the A1, P1 companies, but it's not doing anything for the companies that are the most vulnerable in terms of getting cut off from the money markets.
Jeff, earlier Scott was talking about flashback to Lehman and the race against time. How much do we lose economically every day that we hear, oh, they're not ready with the bailout, with the stimulus or the fiscal package in D.C. Oh, maybe it'll be next week. How urgent is it to get money out the door today?
Well, you're seeing that effect in financial markets right now. I think it's exacerbated a bit by the competition for liquidity between the real economy and the financial economy, and that's forcing a financial economy deleveraging. So I think, just purely looking at financial markets may be overstating the degree of damage to the real economy. Now, that's not to say that there's not real damage here in terms of wealth effect and investors' portfolios, but a lot of what's going on in the markets is this squeeze of liquidity forcing these unwinds. But that is not necessarily indicative of the degree of damage to the real economy. That is in front of us, as Scott was describing in terms of the industries and the potential failures. I think that, the urgency with regards to time, it's a tough question to ask in this environment when we're having a very similar question, with regards to health and safety around flattening the curve and the exponential. So, I don't think it's as dire as those things, and I think that keeps it in its proper perspective. But it's important that we recognize how much progress we've already made. A week ago, we were not here. A week ago, Congress and fiscal policy was not here. Leadership was not here. And now we are. And so I think it's important to highlight that we are making those progress, and that's human flexibility and ingenuity, and with that will come a mitigation. If we wait forever and don't have any of those measures economically, of course, that's going to be pretty damaging.
Then we caught up with Diane Swunk, chief economist at Grant Thornton, and Nick Maroutsis, co-head of global bonds at Janus Henderson.
Well, it's already happening, and as you already laid out, and we've got the same thing here in Chicago now beginning as well, and that is that, people are literally being laid off overnight. I had to cancel my mother's 80th birthday party in May, and I talked to the restaurant where the university town, where they closed the dorms, and the weekend before, kids had shown up who were wait staff who had nowhere to live, and then 2 days later she had to lay them off. It was just heartbreaking, and that's what we're dealing with, is mass layoffs right now. The unemployment, many states have, you know, accelerated that. The unemployment claims tomorrow will be high. We're going to see a big jump the following week. These are millions and millions of jobs overnight, and it's what's so unique about this economic effects is it's just literally a standstill in the overall economy, from the manufacturing sector, plant shutting down, to the service sector. And people who are shut in their apartments and in their homes can literally not go out and go shopping beyond necessity. So this is really a very difficult situation on an economic basis to even model. But it would be, it is important that we have stopgap measures. Even though we cannot prevent the recession that is already we are in, we can make it the ground firmer so that once we get through it, we keep people solvent and firm solvent. Bailouts are going to be out there. People don't like this. Throw your ideology to the wind. This is not the time to be have ideological biases. And we need to be in a place where we can pick up again once the virus abates. And also, we get antiviral drugs and can manage it better with more testing.
Well said, Diane. And of course, from the bottom up, in terms of what you see in the damage in the streets and on the real economy, we're seeing that reflected in financial markets. I have a chart on my terminal here which looks at financial conditions, and clearly there's stress. The white line shows how quickly financial conditions have deteriorated this go round. The blue line shows what happened in the fall of 2008. The y-axis measures the standard deviation of the move. In 2008, the financial conditions worsened by 6.6 standard deviations relative to the mean. Today, it is 5.4 times. Pretty stunning moves, at least in the first 25 days of this cycle here. Nick, bringing you into the conversation, we know the central banks, led by the Federal Reserve, have been doing what they can to ease financial conditions. What do all these extraordinary moves, whether it's interest rate cuts or quantitative easing or new lending facilities, what do they do for the real economy, for the companies that are distressed, versus what does it not do?
Well, look, I think Diane's exactly right when she said that we have to throw our ideologies out the window with respect to bailouts and what's happening in the economy. The critical thing that we're facing now from monetary policy perspective is that the Fed has already cut interest rates to zero. They've done what they can there. They need to start increasing reserves via QE and trying to figure out ways that they can ease credit. And I think the credit easing component is going to be very interesting because it sort of flies into the face of what we saw back in 2008 with bailing out the banks and whatnot. But again, that's all out the window. In addition to that, we're going to see stimulus that is going to be led by fiscal policy, because you can make the case that monetary policy is having less and less of an impact. We're seeing that in the bond space now. Bonds are not rallying as much as they had been previously. We saw the 10-year hit a low of 30 basis points. Now it's trading well over 1%. The effects of fixed income really aren't there. And whether that's an unwinding of the risk parity trade, whether that's the expectations of a large fiscal plan coming down the chute, it remains to be seen. But ultimately, we need to provide the necessary financial relief, such as tax breaks, loan guarantees, subsidized credit, remove the solvency risk and allow these companies to prepare for recovery once the crisis is over. We need to provide a bridge for the consumers and the businesses. And ultimately, that's going to fall on the government and central bank shoulders, and they're going to have to wear that tab.
So, Nick, I mean, when we talk about, I mean, use the word bridge there. I mean, so when we talk about the potential package that we finally do get, which will most likely be multiple packages coming out of Washington and the other major governments around the world, is the idea here that they should be structuring this as something that is short term, meaning a patch to sort of get consumers and businesses over this hump? Or should they be looking at things that are a little bit broader and a little bit more structural in terms of the changes?
Well, to be honest, it's a slippery slope, right? You know, we obviously are in a very much a crisis situation, and it's one that's not really led by a buildup of imbalances like we saw in 2008. This is an exogenous shock that literally came out of the blue, and while that argues for the current slowdown to be short and deep, like Diane said, we are in a recession. I think people need to realize the fact that's certainly the situation that we're in. We do have the ability, potentially, if we can curb the number of infections and get past this, to kind of revert back to similar days of what we were used to, a bit more normalcy. So that definitely, you don't want to run the risk of implementing too big of a a fiscal package to where it becomes harder and harder to unwind, because ultimately I think the demand will come back. It's going to take a lot of time. I think a lot of people are sort of licking their wounds in this space, but you don't want to be in a position where the fiscal stimulus is so large, it's kept on the balance, it kept on the books for far too long, and ultimately that leads to more inflationary pressures down the chute, down the pipe, excuse me.
Okay. Interesting take there. Diane, I want to toss it over to you. What do you think? When Nick says you don't want a fiscal stimulus that's too big, the latest number we had from Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is $1.3 trillion. Is that too big? He's also thrown out numbers like 20% unemployment without government intervention. Is that too big? How do we come up with a number that's reasonable and not too big?
Well, I think actually right now you throw everything to the wind and you do whatever you can to keep, to bridge this period in time. And, you know, whether it's $1 trillion, $1.3 trillion, it's got to be big. Go big, go large. But I think what Nick was pointing to was that, you know, what do you have that lasts after that? Do something temporary now to make sure there is an end date to this virus. There is an end date to the outbreak. Even with a second wave, we'll have more testing. We'll be able to manage it better. We can take the lessons from other countries that have been much more aggressive on testing, much more aggressive on technology, know where hotspots are, be able to not have as many disruptions to our economy and manage the virus even before we have an actual vaccine that'll allow us to ramp up again. But you need to have an economy to ramp up from, and that's the key. The other issue is that the Fed stimulus that we have today, the cuts in rates today, Chairman Powell himself said, this is not going to have much of an effect until we get over this hump. The housing market booming going into this crisis, it is one of the few things that could not drive us out of the recession in 2008, 2009. It is poised to come back if we bridge the COVID-tainted waters.
Okay, well, Diane, just expand on that a little bit, because, I mean, there is this idea of making sure that whatever stimulus we do get, that it is a little bit more targeted, that we're just not sort of raining money down indiscriminately. When you look at the housing market and you look at how it has sort of been the bulwark for a good part of our expansion, our economic expansion coming out of the Great Recession here. Is there a sense here that some of these industries could sort of snap back on their own, or is it just basically now a foregone conclusion that the government basically has to provide some sort of financial assistance to these industries directly?
Well, it's not that the housing market needs financial assistance, but certainly we need assistance to make sure the housing market can come back. We need to make sure that consumers and home buyers, prospective home buyers, the pent-up demand we've got out there, the underbuilding that we've got out there, is not in such a precarious position that they can't come back quickly out of this. And I think that's where we have to focus our efforts, is bridging this period in time. It's not just indiscriminate, but it is hard to discriminate which firms that are close to insolvency were bad before this, and you know, now they should just disappear. We can't afford that luxury right now. That's where the ideology part gets thrown out. But it's not indiscriminate. Right now they're not talking about subsidies for the housing industry. But if we preserve consumers in some way that they can bridge this, they can come out the other side of it and respond to lower interest rates. They're refinancing, the intervention in the mortgage market necessary to keep consumers refinancing, keep the banks are in a better position to do this now. All of that is very important to keep people intact so that they can bounce off of this later on.
Right. I hear what you're saying. I wonder, to Nick, what we're seeing right now, all this shelter in place and the work from home. I mean, you're speaking to us from home right now. Are there going to be permanent behavioral changes as a result? I mean, perhaps more people working from home, certainly on Wall Street, that could continue for a while. Maybe an acceleration to online grocery shopping, an entire generation obsessed with making sure they don't fall short of toilet paper. In the markets, Nick, do you see any kind of behavioral changes that may last beyond the virus outbreak?
Sure, absolutely. And I think that, you know, we are, the way we consume is going to change. The way we work is going to change. And this is a direct result of what's happening with the coronavirus. I mean, the isolation component is a tricky one, because it's forcing people to stay at home. It's forcing kids to stay home from school. And it's really sort of changing the landscape of what we do and how we do it. Now, as it pertains to the markets, you know, I think you're going to probably see a growing number of people wanting to work from home, but this is going to take time. I think ultimately we will get back to a sense of normalcy. And, you know, it's not all doom and gloom out there despite what we're seeing in the marketplace. And, you know, just to clarify the earlier comment that Diane hinted on, is that we want a huge package. We think that it's necessary. Our only argument was more sort of along the line of keeping it around too long. You're seeing other countries like France and New Zealand and Spain implementing fiscal plans that are in excess of 10% of GDP. You know, if the U.S. was to do something of that equivalency, you're talking about close to $2 trillion. So, you know, anything over it, anything with a T behind it, I think is going to have a remarkable effect. But it ultimately boils down to, can we curb the number of infections? We are looking at Asia as an indication of how this could all play out. But ultimately, we need to be looking at Western Europe. You know, the mindset of the Asian countries is quite differently. Geographically, they're typically islands. Culturally, there's more of an authoritarian model. Whatever the government deems necessary, people will generally be on board. I think using the U.S., as some of our colleagues here in Newport Beach and one of our analysts has pointed out, is that even if the U.S. is encouraging social distancing, we should be looking at the European countries as a benchmark, not necessarily Asia.
We are hearing a little bit more from President Trump saying in a tweet that he wants all Americans to understand that, in his words, we are at war with an invisible enemy. He says that it's an enemy that is no match for the spirit and resolve of the American people. Nick, we've seen the tone out of Washington become a lot more serious, become a lot more dire, and frankly, becoming a lot more proactive, which seems to be something that is encouraging to a lot of folks out there, even if it's not necessarily reflected in asset prices. I'm wondering if you can just sort of broaden this out beyond the U.S. borders, because there is still not a global coordinated effort, at least not one that we sort of saw back during the financial crisis and the Committee to Save the World. Is that even necessary at this point? Can sort of individual nations just sort of go this on their own, do what's right for their own nations, and that will somehow synchronize up down the road and we get a global recovery? Or do you think that there is a little bit more coordination between the nations needed?
I think, Romain, certainly coordination is required, because you look at what, like I said earlier, the Asian economies are doing, which is very different than what's happening in the Western economies. And I mean Western Europe, I mean parts of the U.S. Each and every state is doing things differently. You have countries like Australia that are just starting to shut down schools, but then you have the other side of the coin where you have the U.K., which is taking a completely different approach to how they're addressing the coronavirus. They're not necessarily talking about locking people up or keeping people in lockdown, working from home. It's actually more about exposing people, a la the sort of chickenpox mentality. So people are doing things very, very differently. I think fiscally, everybody is on board. From a monetary policy, everybody's coordinated. Rates are going to zero across the board. You're going to see quantitative easing, yield curve control across the board. You're going to see everybody dust off all the old programs that they had in the crisis, whether it's the CPFF, it's the TARP, CALF, whatever you want to name it. The central banks and governments are going to throw every single piece of ammunition behind this than they possibly can.
Okay, so going on that, Diane, you know, we have this temptation to compare what we're seeing right now to the great financial crisis. And for those of us who were covering the crisis or who invested during it or were analyzing economies during that period, it makes sense to interpret things through that prism. But is that a useful frame of reference for investors, for policymakers, or does it hold us back in any way?
Well, I think the important thing is this was a health crisis that is now metastasized into a financial crisis. And we need to stop both from, you know, in terms of we have to control, do everything we can on the healthcare side to manage the health crisis. But we also need to stop the metastasization, the sort of mutation into this financial crisis, because that leaves us even deeper. Recovering from a virus and an illness that stops everything, if you keep a floor on it so that people don't all go insolvent, that is not as hard as recovering from a financial crisis. And making it a dual problem is something we really do have to avoid. And underscoring and dovetailing off what Nick said, the need for coordination on dealing with the pandemic, the global pandemic, is huge. And the idea that we are not only seeing a lack of coordination, but we're also seeing this sort of piecemeal approach by state, in the U.S., by country, that is not helpful. We need to have a unified, coordinated, and I think it really reflects the phrase nerves and the frayed relationships of the last several years, that we've gotten to this point where we don't trust each other anymore. And it's not just a fight for the U.S. We are globally in a fight together against the novel coronavirus.
So, Diane, I mean, we started to see those responses globally. We saw Germany actually take some steps to sort of loosen up credit a little bit, dropping that countercyclical buffer for its banks. We just have a headline crossing the wire that France is also taking its capital buffers for banks down to zero. Would you like to see the U.S. follow that same path?
The U.S. is going to be doing all of that as well. The Federal Reserve, I thought that Yellen and Bernanke's piece today in the Financial Times was very good, their op-ed piece talking about other tools and things they could even intervene in the corporate bond market, get, you know, permission, get coordinate with Congress and Treasury to do things that they did during the crisis, reinstate some of the ability to be much more flexible in dealing with the financial crisis that is now, we're now seeing. And I think that's very important. But I really would like to see much more coordinated effort that we're working on all this together, not all these countries doing this alone. You are seeing things happening synchronously, but it's not coordinated. And I think there is a sense of the whole being greater than the sum of the parts. And the idea that we're battling all this together would be much more powerful for financial markets as well.
Nick, I want to get a final question to you here. When you look across the markets, where do you see the greatest disruption? Is it in FX today with the need for dollars and sterling's move? Five big numbers is just not something you see for a major currency pair. What does that tell you?
So there is obviously a dollar liquidity issue. And the Fed is going to have to step in and increase swap lines or open up the swap lines to other countries outside the G7, and that means emerging market countries, because they don't really have access to that capital. I mean, the biggest dislocation that we see, obviously, is in the credit markets. The market is essentially broken right now, and I think it's growing increasingly less liquid, which means that even more extreme price volatility in the future. And I think for now, until the panic subsides, this is going to be a buyer's market until things improve, and it's going to take some time. We're seeing continuous corporate outflows. And the dynamic is certainly dangerous, particularly when you move to more the lower rated assets, talking about high yield or more the illiquid assets like bank loans and whatnot. Credit easing through the corporate market is going to be an extremely powerful tool that the Fed and other central banks are going to have to look to. And while they're going to have to get some form of government approval for that, or legislative approval for that, because it certainly flies in the face of Dodd-Frank. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, we have to hit the markets that are hit the hardest, and that's going to be the credit side of things.
As the world's major cities inch closer to shutdown, Yossi Sheffy, systems engineering professor and director of the MIT Center for Transportation, joined us to talk about the impact on supply chains. He also offered some suggestions on navigating essential outside trips in the safest way.
We need to start thinking out of the box. We are doing certain things already. There is a push by the federal government and by the military to supply more hospital beds and more healthcare providers. But let's think about the following. We have a huge shortage of nurses, and we have lots of flight attendants who have training in first aid and they have nothing to do. They can serve on a voluntary basis, of course. They can serve frontline in hospital. We also need equipment. Now, instead of when we are talking about beds and masks and gloves and protective equipment, I do not understand even the shortage right now, because the United States has the ability to manufacture. We may have to commandeer some plant, but we have to start making this at a much higher rate. Finally, let me suggest that we can also build, not from one day to the next, but very quickly, sophisticated machine like ventilators, if we start thinking about what's called 3D printing. Hmm. For this, there are companies like General Electric who are building jet engine part with 3D printing, and they have the capacity. They have dozens and dozens of machines. They also make machines, and there are many other companies that can be told or volunteers to start making ventilators, for which we need only the blueprint, the digital blueprint. So in terms of manpower, in terms of the simple stuff, and even in terms of sophisticated stuff, if the private sector in particular get together and start working on this, we should be in this in a matter of 2-3 weeks before we hit the big peak of this of the coronavirus.
Okay, well, that's the if
pandemic.
That's the if, Professor, and you use the words told or volunteered. I guess, is there someone or something that should sort of be coordinating this so that we sort of marshal all of these resources? Or do we have the type of capital markets here where we can sort of trust that private companies will sort of find a way to sort of do this on their own?
We are putting, what, $1 trillion? I mean, you know, a trillion here, a trillion there. Pretty much we are talking about real money. So the money is here.
Yeah.
So the government can start a fund. What we also have to do at this with regard to military and the government to suspend some of the procurement rules. We cannot ask for, you know, several proposals and get the best part and all this. Let's just get it done.
Mm-hmm.
So Congress can suspend many of the procurement rules so we don't have to wait that long. You know, the president is talking about suspending some regulation. These are the regulations right now need to be suspended. A lot of the government and Pentagon procurement rule, so they can buy.
Yeah.
And at this point, the Pentagon, you know, the Pentagon can
sure,
has the money.
Right, right.
So so we can buy for, we can certainly motivate the private sector to change and do something.
Right. Okay, clearly you are an advocate of common sense solutions because these all sound very reasonable. One thing I do want to get your take on, since you are an expert in systems optimization, is the idea of social distancing. People are no longer showing up at work, in the office, they're working from home. Children are not in school anymore, but one place we are congregating is at the supermarket or in front of the supermarket when we're trying to get in, or at the supermarket when we're paying for all of our, what, rice and beans and frozen
Sazon.
Dinners. Yes. Professor, is there a way to avoid people getting too close to each other, infecting each other while they're standing in line trying to buy the groceries so that they can shelter at home?
I am glad you asked this question, because I actually thought about it. And we can do several simple, relatively simple steps. First, by the way, allow stores to charge less. Here in Massachusetts, of course, it's the, you know, somewhat progressive state. We frown on companies charging more for the good. But charging more when demand is high will deter hoarding and will increase supply. Second, we are shortening hours for the supermarket, which is, how shall I say, not great, because you concentrate more people in a smaller number of hours. Mm-hmm. And now let me talk about the process. Stores should divide people into two, segment people into two groups. One group is techie, is people who can operate smartphones. It's basically they need to call ahead and order, establish the time when the store should text them when the order is ready. Customers should take their car and come to the store approximately when time is ready. Text to the store that they are there, open the trunk, stand next, and not get out of the car. Open the trunk, get back into the car, let somebody bring the order into the car and drive away, assuming they're already paid online. By the way, the first two, both the price and this, will also reduce the number of people who are coming to the store and allow the associate to stack the shelf more. Then there's a group who needs to pay cash. They don't speak English, I mean, they're the immigrants. What have you. They need to go to the store. The store should allow only a limited number of the time. I hope with all the other things that the store will do, there will be limited hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can use a numbering system, like you go to the, I don't know, to the DMV. To the parking lot, you take a number, and then they allow only a certain number. You wait in the car, and they allow only a certain number into the store. Another thing they should do, they should make all the aisles one way, so people don't run across from each other. They just, you know, they can keep distance. Finally, at the counter, when they're about to pay, you should make 6 feet apart, or whatever the distance is, lines that people will stand on these lines and not crowd into each other. And by the way, make sure that the cashiers use masks and wear gloves. The combination of all of this will allow us to reduce the number at the store, so people who need it will get to the store and will be able to get the stuff. Final comment.
Final comment.
The name social distancing is wrong.
Okay.
We should call it physical distancing.
Oh,
we should keep
one.
Social connection all the time. In fact, one of the most dangerous thing is to create social distancing. Let's talk from now on about physical distancing.
I like that.
Social distancing, yeah. On all, whether it's on Zoom, whether it's on Hangout, whether it's, you know, telephone, people should keep in touch a lot more even than usual, because that's a danger of isolating people.
That does it for this episode of What You Missed This Week. If you like this, please make sure to subscribe and rate us at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And be sure to tune in to our Market Close show every weekday from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Bloomberg Television and from 4 to 5 p.m. streaming on Twitter. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.